call the Senate Resource Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, March 29th, 2023, and the time is 3:30:29 p.m. Please silence all cell phones. Present today, Co-Chair Geisel, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Klayman, myself, Co-Chair Bishop, Senator Kaufman, and Mr. Dunbar. Senator Dunbar, good afternoon, sir. Senator Wilikowski is presenting another bill in another committee. It's that time of the year where we're going in different directions. I'd like to thank our support staff, Carrie Cooperator and Amanda Kraft. Today's agenda will include SB 87, lumber grading by Senator Bjorkman. SB 92, state ownership of submerged lands by Senator Geisel. And SB 67, PFAS use in firefighting by Senator Keel. First up is the committee has previously set an amendment deadline for Senate Bill 87. That's the amendment deadline for the lumber grading bill. And no amendments were received. So, Senator Geisel, a motion, please.
Sure. All these liquids to get out of the way. Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 87, Work Order 33LS0380/S, as in Sierra, out of this committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Okay. Seeing no objection, that bill passes committee. We will just stay after the end and we'll sign the bill packet so we can keep the flow going here today. State ownership of submerged lands. Senator Geisel.
You get your gavel back.
No, I didn't gavel out. I just passed the bill.
Oh, I thought you. Oh, sorry.
That's fine. That's good. I need all the help I can get. Senator Geisel, you have a committee substitute motion.
Yes, I do. Mr. Chairman, I move that the committee adopt the committee substitute for Senate Bill 92, Work Order 33LS0536/B, Bravo, as our working document.
Thank you. And I'll object for purposes of discussion. The bill sponsor, would you like to explain the changes and see us?
Mr. Huff? Yes, have my staff come up and do that.
Mr. Huff, staff to Senator Geisel.
Slight correction, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Huff is my University of Alaska Ted Stevens intern.
Okay, so which one we got here? He is an intern. You're just correcting me.
That's just adding. Yes.
So, Mr. Huff, you're a university intern?
Through the chair, yes, I am.
And what are you studying?
I'm studying political science.
Okay. How far along are you?
I am a senior who's going to graduate this May.
Okay, congratulations.
Thank you.
And thanks for being here. So if you want to explain the changes to the CS, that'd be marvelous.
Excellent. Thank you, Co-Chair Bishop. The explanation changes for Senate CS Bill, or for the CS for Senate Bill 92, version 33LS0536/A to 33LS0536B, the changes are as follows. In Section 10, page 87, line 25 through 30, and page 88, lines 1 and 2, the following has been deleted. Federal areas mean land within state borders that is managed by a federal agency, including the United States National Park Service, the United States Fish and Wildlife Service, the United States Forest Service, or the United States Department of the Interior Bureau of Land Management, but does not include federally managed land that is subject to a pre-statehood federal withdrawal that clearly and explicitly evinces the intent to defeat state acquisition of title. The following has been added. Federal area means federally owned land within state borders that is managed by a federal agency, including the United States National Park Service, the United States Fish and Wildlife Service, the United States Forest Service, and the United States Department of Interior Bureau of Land Management. Federal areas does not include A, federally managed land that is subject to pre-statehood federal withdrawal that clearly and explicitly evinces the intent to defeat state acquisition of title, and B, land that is privately owned. This change clarifies that it is not the intent of the state to claim privately owned lands, including those of regional and village native corporations. In Section 8, page 3, line 19, a incorrect cross-reference to the definition of navigable water was corrected. And in Section 9, page 63, line 16, a typographical error was removed.
Okay. questions to the CS changes, gentlemen, ladies, and co-chair? With that, seeing none, no further objections, I'm going to remove my objection, and the CS is before the committee. I'd like to invite the bill sponsor to proceed with the bill hearing. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 92 reasserts Alaska's claims to our submerged lands. It allows the state to better define, recognize, determine, and catalog navigable waters and submerged lands in our state. It is important in that it builds on the U.S. Supreme Court's precedents, such as in the John Sturgeon historic litigation and the Golcana River case. So what does the bill do? It allows the following. It allows active management of state-owned navigable waters and lands. It asserts state sovereignty in state and federal land planning initiatives and gives clarity and closure to state ownership. It does this by codifying state ownership, management, and control of navigable waters and submerged lands within federal areas, specifically identifies navigable waters and submerged lands. That's why the bill's so long. And it requires an annual legislative report. It requires criteria for DNR's navigability determinations and has a zero fiscal note. The bill, as I mentioned a moment ago, is 88 pages long, but the substance of the bill is actually only 6 pages. The new language are sections 8 and sections 10 through 13. The rest of the bill is simply names of the waters that are being referenced here. Many, you will notice, are actually unnamed waters. You will hear some terms, mean high water, which means the average of all the high water heights observed over a data collection time. Mean high water line, the intersection of that tidal water with the shore. And ordinary, high water mark, which means the line on the shore that is typically identified through physical characteristics. I mean, when we've gone fishing or boating, I mean, you can see where the ordinary high watermark is by looking at the land. So that's basically what the bill does, Mr. Chairman. My Senate intern, my UA intern, can go through a sectional if you so desire.
Please.
Through the chair, this is the sectional analysis for Senate Bill 92. Section 1 amends the law by adding a new section to state the purpose of the act. Section 1 states the purpose of the act is to assert the state's ownership an interest in all submerged land underlying navigable water since the date of statehood. The statement of purpose specifically calls out state-owned submerged lands within the boundaries of and adjacent to federal areas. Section 2 amends Alaska Statute 3804062A. Section 2 clarifies that the state owns all submerged lands underlying navigable waters from the date of statehood through the Equal Footing Doctrine, including those within the boundaries of and adjacent to federal lands. Section 3 adds the additional obligation of the Department of Natural Resources Commissioner to conduct ongoing research to identify submerged lands within and adjacent to federal areas to make state title determinations. Section 4 amends language that points to the time of statehood to language that points to the date of statehood instead. Section 4 also creates an obligation for the commissioner to maintain a list of all waters in the state for which the commissioner determines are non-navigable. Section 5 clarifies that water not included on the lists of navigable and non-navigable is considered either until the commissioner, is not considered either until the commissioner has made a determination of navigability. Section 5 also adds a citation to refer to lists and determinations under Alaska Statute 3804063, as well as those existing in subsections B and C. Section 6 serves as a disclaimer for the commissioner's determinations made under subsection B and C in that they may not be representative of final action and may not be recorded and does not create new property. Section 7 clarifies that the language defining the date of statehood in regard to the definition of non-navigable water. Section 8 amends and adds new subsections under Alaska Statute 3804062H through J that create obligations for the commissioner. Subsection H creates an added obligation for the commissioner, requiring him to submit an annual report to the legislature. The report shall identify navigable waters within or adjacent to federal areas not listed in Alaska Statute 3804063 subsection B, as well as changes to previously identified navigable water. Subsection I clarifies the failure to include or identify navigable waters does not relinquish the state's rights regarding those submerged lands. Subsection J clarifies that determinations of navigability will be consistent with the definition of navigability and be based on corroborating evidence. Subsection J also outlines criteria for navigability. Section 9 makes it clear that since statehood, Alaska owns, claims, occupies, possesses, manages, and controls all submerged lands underlying navigable waters. In subsection B of Section 9, it creates a list of navigable waters within and adjacent to federal areas, which comprises the bulk of the bill. Subsection 10 adds a definition section for the following terms: federal area, mean high water line, navigable water, ordinary high water mark, and submerged lands. Section 11 repeals the previous definition under Alaska Statute 3804062G1. Subsection 12 amends the law to make it retroactive to January 3rd, 1959, the date of statehood. Because of subsection 12, this bill will require a special vote of 2/3 of the members of each house because the proposed retroactive effective date for the section varies from the standard language providing for an effective date of 90 days after enactment. And the final section, section 13, provides for an immediate effective date.
Okay. Questions of Mr. Huff on the sectional analysis? Seeing none, thank you. We now have an invited testimony, or at this point of our agenda. And in person, we have Mr. Walker, Section Chief, Department of Natural Resources, and Daniel Hovensick, Natural Resources Specialist, Department of Natural Resources, and is there Deputy Commissioner, who's not in the room, so. Gentlemen, put yourselves on the record, please. Proceed.
Thank you and good afternoon. For the record, my name is Jim Walker. I'm the Section Chief of the Public Access Assertion and Defense Section of the Division of Mining, Land, and Water, Alaska Department of Natural Resources. It's a pleasure to be before this committee in support of Senate Bill 92. State-owned submerged lands in federal areas. As we move into the discussion of what this bill does, I think it is important first to frame the issue. And so as we look at the navigable waters issue statewide, a couple of things that I like to keep in mind. First, if you look at the entire state of Alaska, we hold approximately 800,000 miles of navigable rivers. We hold approximately 30 million acres of navigable lakes. And the law provides, pursuant to the Equal Footing Doctrine of the United States Constitution, the Federal Submerged Lands Act, and the Alaska Statehood Act, that the state of Alaska owns those submerged lands under every navigable, in fact, and tidally influenced water statewide, with one exception. That exception being a valid pre-statehood withdrawal. So that means that in federal areas, particularly federal conservation system units, or CSUs, statewide that were created post-statehood, the state of Alaska owns those submerged lands. On the screen in front of you, you see a variety of areas where the state of Alaska owns the submerged lands. Looking from top to bottom, we see the National Park Service first. within the Noatak National Preserve, a post-statehood federal CSU. The state owns the submerged lands. Same with Kobuk Valley and so forth. Then there's a couple that I'd like to point out. Denali National Park and Preserve. In Denali, there was a core, specifically the McKinley Monument. And for that pre-statehood withdrawal that expressly included the submerged lands, the state does not own those submerged lands. However, around that central core, over time, as area was added to the Denali National Park and Preserve, think concentric circles forming out, under all of those post-statehood additions to Denali, the state owns the submerged lands. The same is also true with Katmai. There was a core that constitutes the Katmai National Monument, a pre-statehood withdrawal that expressly excludes the the submerged lands includes the submerged lands within the withdrawal. Hence, the state doesn't own those submerged lands within that pre-statehood national monument. For the Anilka additions to Katmai, the state owns the submerged lands. So this is a vast amount of areas, inholdings, if you will, within these federal areas where the state owns the submerged lands. The bill itself right now, 82 pages of that bill is a list. And that list identifies each and every river in the National Park Service areas, the United States Forest Service areas, and one U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service area that we contend and the legislation provides were owned by the state of Alaska from the date of statehood onwards. It is our hope that if this legislation passes, pursuant to the reporting requirement, we would be back next session and hopefully be able to report that our work on the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service areas has now concluded. And we would ask that that list be added to. We would ask all of those Fish and Wildlife Service areas to be added. The following year, general BLM lands, and so forth, until we have covered all federal areas statewide, and then there would be an ongoing obligation on the department for quality assurance and quality control. As everyone on the committee knows, we are involved in extensive litigation with the federal government. Some of those rivers are within these federal areas. As we get decisions, judgments from the federal court, we would then come back and report. On this particular river, we identified a conservative upstream extent here. We won more before the federal court. The boundary needs to be set higher upstream so that the list that we provide through this legislation is accurate, it's timely, and it's kept up to date. This list that is contained within the statute relates to an active digital map that the state maintains on its website so that every river, every lake that is listed in this legislation has a corresponding identification on a particular map. So the public, federal agencies, state agencies, my own division can look at that map, understand who owns the submerged lands, and act accordingly. So if it is, for example, the general public, they can look at a particular federal area and see, oh, this is state property to this confluence with this river. Hence, if I am going to conduct my activities there, I need to follow state law. If I step above the ordinary high water mark, for example, I would be on federal land. I better make sure I comply with federal law. That's how it works together, and that's how we will keep this very fresh and very relevant for the general public, for other state agencies, federal agencies, you name it. The reason that this effort is so timely, I think is best explained with the slide that's before us. If we look at everything that has been done from the date of statehood to present time, the federal government has only acknowledged state ownership of 9% of those 800,000 river miles statewide and only 16% of those 30 million acres of submerged lands. If we do not take bold action to call this question, to force closure and resolution, fulfilling this vital, fundamental promise of Alaska's statehood, part of our birthright, if you will, is going to take hundreds of years at this pace. Hence, that is the genesis of this legislation, that by taking a bold statement and identifying with specificity those lands that belong to the state, we are calling the question with our federal counterparts. We are telling them either you acknowledge and acquiesce in our ownership or you object. And if you object, you are claiming an interest in those lands and putting a cloud on our title that would give us the necessary standing to begin litigation pursuant to the Federal Quiet Title Act in federal court. It calls the question more than anything else. Much of the impetus for our statewide statehood defense initiatives, you know, is found in John Sturgeon's case. And John Sturgeon, I believe, will be testifying later in support of this bill. But building on those precedents, building upon the other successes that we have had in the courtroom, we have employed the same painstaking analysis to these federal areas. Areas where the federal government loves the ambiguity, right? They love any lingering doubts because their attitude has always been, maybe it is navigable, maybe it isn't navigable. But until such time as we say it is, we're going to treat it like it's not, and thereby frustrate state interests. By enacting this legislation and fitting it within our larger statehood initiatives, it is our hope that this will force an end to that status quo and that we can bring closure at long last to these fundamental issues of state sovereignty. With that, if there are any questions, I was going to turn the mic over to my colleague, Danny Hovancek.
Mr. Dunbar, you're good. I have a statement, but I'll make it after the end of the presentation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. You reserve the right. Mr. Hovancek.
For the record, Daniel Hovancek, Division of Mining, Land, and Water, Department of Natural Resources. Co-Chair Bishop, Co-Chair Kiesel, members of the committee. The state of Alaska has identified 9 actions that assert state ownership and authority when it relates to statehood defense and navigability. These are the tools of the public access assertion and defense team, the tools we employ on a regular basis in dealing and trying to solve these issues. I'll direct your attention to the 12 o'clock position. This is one of our most effective tools, and that's quiet title litigation. Every river within a federal CSU is either navigable or it is non-navigable. The ambiguity that stands serves to help no one, and the people of Alaska suffer. If a non-navigability determination exists and the state disagrees with it, we can file a quiet title action and get that settled in a courtroom and understand exactly how far upstream navigability extends. In the case of ambiguity, we have an administrative remedy. That's in the 5 o'clock position. These are recordable disclaimers of interest. We can file these with the federal government, in which we provide facts, in which we provide our own navigability determination, and then we wait to see if they agree. This was intended to be the simple and the easy process forward. It was intended to expedite navigability determinations. It has unfortunately broken. We have a tremendous backlog, and we do not see any movement whatsoever from the RDI process. We believe that the legislation in front of this committee is another route forward for our department and is another option available to us for these efforts. Of all the actions listed above, none of them exist in a vacuum. They're all interrelated and rolled into each other, and they strengthen our hand if employed all at once.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question here?
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The last thing you said there, this strengthens our hand. So is there, with regard to the highlighted bullet, or whatever you want to call it there, legislatively codify state-owned navigable waters, is there a federal law that says that we should do this? Or has there a federal agency that indicates that doing this will strengthen our hands, as you described?
Through the chairs, Senator Dunbar, Jim Walker, for the record, Alaska Department of Natural Resources. There is no existing federal law that says that we should take this action. However, it is our hope that this legislation, and working closely with our congressional delegation, we will lead the way. We will hopefully, through corresponding complementary federal legislation, enact the gravamen of this bill as some type of federal counterpart. That is the hope of what might come from this, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Kawasaki.
Mr. Chair, basically what we're saying is if it's in state law, then it's the truth. I mean, is that really what we're getting at?
Through the chairs, Senator Kawasaki. What we are saying is that this is an important issue that requires a statement by our legislator to state what is Alaska's, the land set where Alaska was promised at the statehood. It is much more significant that it comes from our legislature than it is from Jim Walker signing a navigability determination, or even the department, the commissioner signing a navigability. This is the voice of Alaska, and that is very significant. To your question of how we go about this, and if this is just a matter of state law, the answer is that we have employed in our navigability determinations all of the body of law that is found through the federal case law, right? Starting with the Daniel Ball decision many, many years ago. And all of the cases that have been decided since that time, there has been developed a robust case law of what navigability means. And it means things somewhat differently depending upon the state. So, for example, the state where I'm originally from is the state of Tennessee. It became a state in 1796. Alaska became a state in 1959. The law says you look to determine navigability as of the date of statehood using watercraft that were traditional at the time. The types of watercraft that were used in 1959 are pretty much what we have today versus 1796. They were much more primitive. So to your question, Senator Kawasaki, it is a bold statement under our Alaska statutes of what we own, but it is a statement that is informed through application of federal case law to the facts of these Alaska rivers and lakes.
Thanks. And then just one follow-up, Mr. Chair. I guess you mentioned Tennessee, 1796. What do other states do to assert their ownership of submerged lands?
Through the chairs, Senator Kawasaki. Essentially the cases are going to be very similar, right? The fact of the matter is, though, that a lot of the issues that we are now deciding and that this legislation addresses were decided by the state of Tennessee in the 19th century, right? Through cases that were decided during that time frame. Because of our newness as a state, we are deciding those issues now. But in terms of looking at how you establish ownership of the submerged lands, you prove the navigability of the river. You prove the tidal influence of the river. And the way that you do that is you show through either historical proof that it was used as a route for trade, travel, or commerce, or you show that the river is in its natural and ordinary condition, and you can presently float the river in a boat that is meaningfully similar to a watercraft that was used at the date of statehood for trade, travel, or commerce. That's, you know, sort of the nuts and bolts of how you go about proving navigability, and it doesn't matter which state you're in. What does matter is the date of statehood in terms of your proof.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, I had a good question, and I lost it. I had a senior moment. I wanted to come back to a comment you made. And if I could, I might paraphrase, and I don't want to take your words out of context, so correct me if I'm wrong, but you had said something that we own the waters, submerged lands. We don't have title to it yet. We're trying to get title to it, so we do own it. Is that correct? Am I right or wrong?
Through the chair, Chair Bishop, I would respectfully submit we have title to it now. Mm-hmm. All this bill does is clarify where we are claiming title. We got it at the date of statehood. It vested immediately on January 3rd, 1959, in the state of Alaska. However, there are lingering questions about how far upstream it may be specifically navigable. And those are the questions that are clarified through this bill. We are not adding anything to the state's inventory than it already has. All this bill does is clarify what we own. And also remember that this is not land that we selected. We got our lands in Alaska through two routes. One, through our statehood selections. And then separately, completely apart from that, we received, pursuant to the Equal Footing Doctrine, the lands under navigable, in fact, and tidally influenced waters. That doesn't count against our selections. And those immediately vested in us on the date of statehood.
Thank you. I'd like to recognize that Senator Wilkowski just joined us, and we did put on the record that you were busy in another committee. Please continue. So, Senator Kaufman has a question.
Thank you. Through the chair to Mr. Walker. I believe what I'm hearing is that you're saying that we do have title, but it is currently a clouded title, and this is the opportunity to remove the cloud by these processes.
Through the chairs, Senator Kaufman, I'm saying something slightly different but very close. When you say there is a cloud on title, that describes a legal state by which two people claim ownership to the same property, where both parties say, I own that. That is truly a cloud. Here, what the federal authorities have done is a bit more sneaky, if you will. They have taken the position, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. We haven't said yet. And until such time as we do, we're just going to treat it like it's non-natural. I would describe that as ambiguity and not a legal, as that term, as it means within the law, cloud on title. But you are right. This bill, what it primarily does is it removes those ambiguities from the clean title owned by the state of Alaska.
Senator Clayman.
Am I correct that these questions about ownership of submerged lands are getting litigated slowly in federal court?
Through the chairs, Senator Clayman, yes.
Follow up.
So what we're essentially doing with this legislation is saying we're asserting a claim to a bunch of land, submerged lands, and we actually don't know whether how the federal government is going to respond. This may or may not lead to more litigation. It may lead to less litigation. We actually don't really know what the federal government is going to do in response to this.
Through the chair, Senator Clayman, It seems to me that they can do one of two things. Either they can say, no, you're wrong. We own these lands. And hence, we then have the necessary standing to begin proceedings pursuant to the Federal Quiet Title Act. Or they can do what we are increasingly seeing through state assertions of ownership. And the example I would raise is Crescent Lake within Lake Clark National Park and Preserve. In that particular lake, a deep lake, very popular for all types of recreation, we made a navigability determination. We said this is state-owned property. And as a result, various entities applied for permits to do certain things. For example, one commercial outfitter applied for a mooring buoy permit for the lake that would facilitate, you know, bringing their guests to the area. Another operator filed an application to store their boats over the winter months below the ordinary high water mark. The idea being is that under federal National Park Service regulations, they had to fly those boats out in the winter, right? They applied for these permits. As part of our adjudication of these permits, we sent out notice to all the upland owners, which in this case is the Park Service. And they said something very significant. They didn't say, you can't do this. They didn't say, you don't own this land. They said, you shouldn't do this. And they gave some reasons. And we looked at those reasons, or rather the adjudicators looked at those reasons, and they said, some of these have merit. And so they required the applicant to modify their application. And then in other cases, they said, no, we've considered this, and we think that the permit should be issued. But what that marked was, I think, an important watershed moment in federal-state relations, namely that they treated Alaska like a sovereign. They talked to Alaska like another sovereign. They didn't say, you can't do this. They said, you shouldn't do this, and here's why. That, to me, is the foundation for a partnership that we would enjoy as neighbors moving forward. And we are seeing that elsewhere throughout the state, that there is generally an acquiescence to state ownership in many cases when they feel that we have done the necessary analysis and made the decision based upon application of sound federal law to the facts of the case.
Follow up, and then Senator Dunbar.
Well, you've articulated what you think the federal government should or shouldn't do, but you're actually not here representing the federal government, and they could do any number of things, including the two you described, but exactly how the federal government responds to this, we actually don't know. Am I correct?
Through the chairs, absolutely. I cannot read their minds. I'm not representing the federal government.
And just one more follow-up. It just strikes me that how successful this is or isn't, or whether this leads to loads of litigation in the short term, or whether the federal government might say, well, kind of interesting, but we're going to still going on these very slow, plodding path of litigating. I'm not sure whether this leads to any specific result in terms of how the federal government responds to this. And they're not here today to tell us how they're going to respond. So I find it interesting, but I'm not sure the goal of the legislation is actually going to produce the result that you're describing. I just don't know.
Senator Dunbar?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was going to hold this comment till the end, but I think it goes well off of what Senator Klayman just said, and then I can listen to the rest of the presentation. So I agree with what Senator Klayman said, and Mr. Walker, you and I have spoke about this as well. I think the third and sort of most likely outcome or approach by the federal government would probably be to sort of ignore this, to ignore us passing this bill and not make any significant change in policy. And continue on this slow case-by-case basis. And the truth is, I actually agree with the sort of legal underpinnings of this. I happen to do my thesis on the equal footing doctrine, which is interesting. And so I agree with what we're saying here. But the truth is, none of these questions are settled until it's settled in federal court. And sort of similar to, I had to look up the term, nullus tempus occurrit, to regi or regi, Senator Wachowski will have to tell me how to pronounce the Latin. But no time runs against the king. You know, it's this idea that there's no adverse possession of federal or state lands, government lands. Similarly, we can assert this, but the federal government not taking any action won't mean that they have acquiesced. They can always come back and say, no, this is ours, and then we have to litigate it in federal court. Similarly, you administratively could have created that useful map, and I think you are creating that useful map for Alaskan landowners, and they could rely on that map. And an administratively created map would have the same legal effect as a state legislatively created map, which is to say, binds the state, but doesn't bind the federal government in a meaningful way. They could always come back and relitigate this. So I agree with what we're asserting. I agree with the list you have produced, I think. But I guess I sort of disagree with the notion this is a calling the question in a meaningful way. I think that they can always ignore it, and they can always come back and override us. Doesn't mean we necessarily shouldn't pass it, because again, I think we're right. It just doesn't, I think, meaningfully change things. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No. Oh, Senator Geisel. Commissioner Geisel.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps I should have articulated this from the get-go. The purpose of this bill is to help our state move forward. We know what the federal government has said to us in the past. In the Statehood Act, it's in Section 6M, submerged lands. The state shall have the same rights as do existing states thereunder. And then we have ANILCA. And there's a whole section, well, actually, they repealed the section in ANILCA and instead passed Public Law 100-395, which in Title I, Sections 101 to 103, is an entire section on submerged lands. And the possession that the state has thereof. You know, we talk about, well, we need to do something to increase our economy, we need to move our state forward. That's exactly what this bill is about doing. And, you know, I get that I admit fully that I am not a lawyer. And so I don't look for opportunity for lawsuits all over the place. I get that could bring this, but I would call out the Sturgeon case. A citizen had the courage to take it forward on behalf of the state and paid hundreds of thousands of dollars of his own money. I think the legislature needs to stop speaking out of both sides of their mouth. Just my opinion. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
This is going to be fun.
Please continue.
For the record, Daniel Hovancic, DNR. This bill does four things to try to shake loose the status quo that we have discussed at length so far in this meeting. We will go forward and discuss each of these in detail, but I'll briefly elaborate on how they would help us as a department achieve our departmental goals. One, it codifies State of Alaska ownership, management, and control of navigable waters and submerged lands within federal areas not covered by pre-statehood withdrawal. This would make clear the extent of our authority as well as the process by which we assert our authority. Number two, it lists specific navigable waterways within these federal CSUs. It lists them by name. It lists them down to the aliquot part level. This leaves, beyond a shadow of a doubt, answers the question of what waters we are asserting in this particular action. It answers where state law begins and ends and where federal law begins and ends from our DNR perspectives. Three, it enshrines foundational elements of relevant case law in navigability determinations. In particular, this draws that important line between the relevant authorities that are existent in case law, the things we use as guides, and helps us justify our administrative actions and the actions that we have taken in forming this list by speaking directly to the federal case law that we use as a guide moving forward, and frankly, the federal case law that we would hope the federal managers would use moving forward as well. And finally, it establishes an annual reporting requirement and charges DNR with the responsibility of conducting ongoing research to better fulfill navigability determinations. This reporting requirement would also ensure that this list reflects reality as best as possible and can be refined in the future if quiet title litigation were to continue, and if our understanding of the geography increases, we can annually ensure that that list is refined. So as we go through this, we'll just look at the codification element. Why would we want to do this? We've already discussed this is a natural process for a state. Every other state that has entered the union has received the submerged lands between their beds and banks. They're all by different legal standards, and they have all established their own bodies of case law. It has been 64 years, and the percentages of lands that we believe to be navigable, the percentages that we hold clear title on that do not have that ambiguity, are impressively small, as we've discussed earlier today. If this bill does nothing else, it is a powerful education tool to bring clarity to the individual who's looking to recreate on these rivers, to commercial guides, and to managers. The current situation, if a commercial operator were to submit an authorization or a permit to the Department of Natural Resources, individuals within the regional offices would have to contact our section, specifically analyze and convey what part of the river was intended to be used, and we would have to go forward with the navigability determination specifically for that area. This effort is a way to address those en masse and to make that more streamlined and to make the management process in the regional offices more simple. Finally, we believe this bill reflects reality in many ways. There is no land conveyance that will occur. If this body chooses to pass this law, there are no quitclaim deeds that fall out of that action. We have owned these lands, as mentioned, since January 3rd, 1959. Moving on.
Slide 10.
Slide 10. Number two, I will speak specifically to the list. This is the list that makes up the bulk of the legislation. It makes up about 83 of the 88 pages. This list was created by five PCNs in the Public Access Assertion and Defense section over the course of 2 years. These individuals were assessing each water body, looking at historical aerial images, modern-day aerial images. They'd look at actual modern-day use accounts from hunters, from boaters, from hikers. They'd look at archival use accounts from miners. We went through state files. We went through actually federal files to see how they have traveled on these rivers and mentions of them regulating certain boat use and whatnot. And then we have put together this list that is before you. We have discussed what is contained in it. The active, what is currently in the list are all National Park System units and all Forest System units, as well as the Tetland Wildlife Refuge, and we've gone over how that will commence. This is not a new structure. We did not make this up. This comes from the RS-2477 right-of-way codification project in the 90s. The benefits that we have seen from that as managers, the benefits that that has brought to the public, is part of the impetus for us moving this bill and bringing it in front of your committee.
Senator Dunbar, but before I go to you, I want to come back to something you just said so I don't forget it. Can you give me the four qualifications again for testing your test to get to point A? So go down the list again, the four.
Yes, Co-Chair Bishop. What we were using to create this list is historical images pulled off of 1950s imagery, most commonly. We have modern-day images. This is Maxar aerial imagery. Alaska high-res imagery that we have collected. The age for that is roughly 2023 to the oldest image we have is there's one slide from 2008. And so it's modern-day images. We have use accounts, so archival use accounts from miners, different anecdotal accounts or ways that people traveled across the landscape that we've seen in the historical record and have had historians vet. And then we have modern-day use accounts. So you can think of a whitewater guidebook or a packraft book.
Back to the historical piece, you talk about the miners, and I got to be careful here because I get in trouble with my wife because her people have been here 10,000 years. When I made the miner comment, I got in trouble from her. But So how about the native population with the indigenous people? Do you use any of their historical accounts and trade routes and et cetera, et cetera?
Co-Chair Bishop, absolutely. The one that comes to mind is up Alatna Portage, okay, which is a portage over from Helpney Jack Creek to Kachayakaka Creek. And that's one that we saw a significant native use, and we're able to determine navigability on both of those creeks in the Southern Brooks Range for that purpose.
Thank you, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does could the department publish this list, or does the department publish this list and any corresponding maps administratively?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, yes, we did.
You did. So you've already published this list and the maps for the public.
Through the chairs, Senator Dunbar, yes. It is currently out on Alaska Mapper. We do have this list. It is always being updated, as I'm sure you can imagine. But there's also corresponding numbers associated. You will see SWFA numbers within the bill. That's state, water, federal area. And then that will be tied to a corresponding file. I believe that file system is just getting established or is forthcoming.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please continue.
So we have gone over what is currently included, and we've gone over what we can expect in the future, as well as the similarities to the 2477 project. I will take a quick look at if you were an individual user on the waterways of Alaska and you wanted to understand what body of law you needed to follow, this might be a map you would encounter if you were following federal regulators. What you see on the screen, the tan areas are federal CSUs. You'll take note of we have removed the valid pre-statehood withdrawals in Glacier Bay, Katmai, Denali, and the North Slope from this map. The lines on your screen are major rivers in Alaska. The blue are rivers that the federal government deems as navigable. The pink are rivers that they haven't made up their mind yet about, haven't made up their mind as to the navigability of these rivers. If this bill were to pass and we were to implement our system, this map would change to look a little more like this. Basically, all the pinks have become blue. Please note that this is a coarse filter because it is a statewide overview of a very intricate dynamic natural system. To get a better idea of how this would change at a granular level, let's take a trip to the Northwest Arctic. We're going to go to the Noatak National Preserve and the Kobuk Valley National Park.
Mr. Chair, could I ask a question before that?
Sure.
Just something you just said. If this bill were to pass, the map would change to this. But even if the bill weren't to pass, it would still change to this, right? Because this is what we actually own, and this is what you've mapped.
Through the chairs, Senator Dunbar, that is correct. We have created this map. I believe that codifying the bill would perhaps allow a unified, more significant statement for the user to experience this, as that is Alaska law rather than an administrative determination. But you are correct, the map has been created and it would look like that.
So let's go back and map.
Yes, sir.
Please. So the question is, for me, on this map, if I took my boat on one of these pink places, am I going to be cited by the federal government?
Co-Chair Bishop, there is a possibility that you could be cited by the federal government in that instance.
Okay. And Co-Chair Bishop, also to follow up on that answer, Jim Walker, for the record, Alaska Department of Natural Resources. John Sturgeon's case. John, one of the reasons he succeeded in that litigation is that the Nation River had been determined navigable, right? So the state had the authority to regulate what types of uses, and I'm not talking consumptive uses, I'm talking about boat usage and whatnot, what types of usage could be utilized for the flowing waters above those state-owned submerged lands. Right now, on the map in front of you, this is the federal perspective. This is where they are saying, oh, there's uncertainty here, and we are going to act like the owners until we decide whether it is navigable or not, right? That is what their perspective is depicted upon this map. By adopting the new map, and again, we'll go down into the granular level in a moment, but here, these are areas that we believe are fully navigable. If we are involved in litigation with the federal government, we have an extraordinarily high degree of confidence we will win on these rivers.
Next question. So on the blue map, if this bill passes, I take my boat on this blue map, and it's still in question now on navigability with the feds. So are you going to defend me then?
Chair Bishop, that is one of the primary reasons for this map, so that the state can assert the rights of all Alaskans. One of the things that worries me the most about these maps is that someone unwittingly becomes or places themselves in the position of becoming the next John Sturgeon, who does not want to do that. I am always looking in the pursuit of our mission to find ways to insert the state between the federal government and the individual citizen. With this map, with a strong declaration from the Alaska legislature that we...
No, I'm just, you keep going. I got three lawyers. I threw one question out there and got three lawyers fired up. So let's go ahead, finish your comment.
This gives us skin in the game. We have got a stake in this litigation, and this represents our best understanding of what is and is not navigable. We would welcome litigation on any of the rivers depicted in blue, because we will win.
Senator Dunbar, and Senator Wilikowski, and then Senator Klayman, in that order.
I'll just say briefly, even if this bill doesn't pass, I would hope that we would insert ourselves and defend the person based on this blue map. This blue map, which, again, you administratively have put out there, which is the best description of our legal understanding of the land we own. So, again, you could get cited by the federal government, regardless of whether or not we pass this bill, and we could defend that person, regardless of whether or not we pass this bill. Is that true?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, I think the position, and we have Ron Opsahl from the Alaska Department of Law on the telephone, but I would respectfully submit that if we do not have something that affirmatively states this is state-owned property, that citizen is likely going to find themselves on their own.
But
if we have the skin in the game in that situation, the state has asserted an interest, and therefore there is a right that we can vindicate on behalf of all Alaskans.
Mr. Opsahl, Senior Assistant Attorney General, Anchorage is online for questions. Are you following the conversation, and did you hear Senator Dunbar's question?
Yeah, this is Ron Opsahl, Department of Law, for the record. I'm following as closely as I can. It's hard to hear the committee members.
Senator Dunbar, would you restate your question?
We administratively, as a state, have put out this list and this map, and we say this is the state-owned land. And so if a citizen is cited by the federal government and gets involved in litigation with the federal government, do we now, without this legislation, have the ability to intervene in those cases? And would that ability change whether or not we pass this law?
Through the chair, I don't believe we would intervene, as that means legally. Our intervention would be more, as it's more commonly understood. I mean, we wouldn't file a motion to intervene into a lawsuit. What we would most likely do is file a quiet title action based upon the federal government's assertion that they owned it, as indicated by them citing somebody. And at that point, that person then could use our litigation to either dismiss or stay whatever proceedings were against them on their citation.
Can we do that now?
Yes, we can. The difference is, once we codify a list, the citizens know more about what we assert our ownership is. And I don't know that we would get citations happening quietly that we don't know about once the public is aware that there's a list and we're claiming those rivers. Without the public understanding what rivers we actually have title to, I don't know that they come to Mr. Walker's unit when they get that citation.
Senator Wilikowski.
Mr. Chairman, I think many Alaskans appreciate the position that you've taken, the aggressive stance that you've taken to protect our waterways. And when it's regarding the federal government, and I'm just curious, does the department take the same aggressive position when landowners are blocking access to recreational areas, for example, the Chugach State Park or Campbell Lake, for example? Does the department file lawsuits in those cases? And if not, why not?
Through the chairs, Senator Wilikowski, I think the short answer to your question is yes, we do. When there are efforts to impede the public's ability to use the flowing waters or to otherwise exercise the rights that they have pursuant to the public trust doctrine and otherwise to use the submerged lands and flowing waters, I think the general answer is yes. As you brought up the example of Campbell Lake, with Campbell Lake, it is a bit of a confused situation. There was a lot of misunderstandings by a lot of the landowners who purchased their property along the lake. I think that those are good faith misunderstandings. And further, there is a question as to the extent of the state's submerged land ownership. For example, Campbell Lake, as we know, was formed by a dam, right? It dammed up Campbell Creek. We believe that Campbell Creek itself was a navigable, in fact, waterway at the date of statehood. So the state would own the submerged lands from the ordinary high water mark on the left bank to the ordinary high water mark on the right bank. But that is largely underneath the now pooled waters of Campbell Lake. So, yes, we own some submerged lands down there. But most of the usage of Campbell Lake, no one's interested in the submerged lands. They want to use the flowing waters, right? And I think that we have very affirmatively, as a department, along working with the municipality, said that the public has a right, absolutely, to use the flowing waters or the surface waters of Campbell Lake. Further, we have identified the section line easements and the other public access easement that provide access to the waters. And I'm advised that yesterday in House Finance, they appropriated $10,000 for the Alaska Department of Natural Resources to sign those access points to inform the public of how they get to the waters of Campbell Lake to enjoy those waters. So the facts are a bit different, as opposed to some of these more clear-cut disputes that we have with the federal government. But in terms of advocating for the public's right to enjoy the flowing waters of Campbell Lake, we have done that. And we have done that on numerous other rivers statewide where individuals have tried to block access or otherwise prevent the citizenry from doing what they would like to with the flowing waters of this river, this lake, that lake.
Senator Klayman.
I just want to touch base on a couple of things. One was, the earlier question was asked, I think, by the chair of the meeting today, what happens if you put your boat on one of the pink rivers on the map, and are you going to get a ticket? And I think the answer to that, having put my boat on some rivers that probably are pink on this chart, is that the odds you get a ticket are pretty darn low. Nobody's out there patrolling these rivers. Nobody's out there kind of saying, don't put your boat on the river. In large measure, people are going to go down the river if they can, and they're going to do the thing, and they're going to leave. And nothing is going to come of it. But where I'm a little troubled by the, you didn't really answer the question that the chair asked, and then I think that the attorney did answer, which is that if you're on the river like Mr. Sturgeon, and you get a ticket from the federal government, the state is not going to come in and represent the individual Alaskan on that ticket. The state might file a quiet title action, but the person that gets the ticket is on their own. And Mr. Sturgeon, I think, with substantial contributions from other individuals, paid about $1 million in this case over time. But I don't hear you saying the state's going to come in and represent the chair in his lawsuit when he gets a ticket. What I hear is you might file a quiet title action, but the chair's going to be on his own with his ticket. And tell me if I missed something.
Through the chair, Senator Clayman. In that scenario, a boat user on one of the pink or red waters depicted here, one of the things that I think having this statute in place that would be a benefit is if that boat operator does get ticketed and shows up to court, and he can point to an Alaska statute that says the state of Alaska owns it, I submit that that creates a reasonable doubt in his particular case. I submit that list provides pretty compelling evidence that he didn't have the requisite mens rea or otherwise to have committed any type of criminal offense. More importantly,
I said, Mr. Chair, I don't need to hear the whole answer.
No, that's fine. But I
mean, I think that
I'd like to hear it because I got a question.
Right. I would just note that Sturgeon was not charged criminally. It's not a criminal case. It was a civil case.
So just tell me, what court would somebody go in? Federal court or state court?
Chair Bishop, if someone were cited by federal authorities, you would go before a federal magistrate, is my understanding. And we have seen instances where individuals, one fairly recently, was cited by federal authorities for motorized usage on something that the federal government contended was non-motorized. I am advised, that individual's case was dismissed. It was a water that the state had affirmatively asserted through quiet title litigation belongs to the state of Alaska. And the pendency of that action, I am advised, gave the magistrate pause, and the magistrate dismissed the case.
Brief at ease. The record. Okay, slide 13.
For the record, Daniel Havancic, Department of Natural Resources. What we have here is a zoom in on NOAATAC National Preserve in Kobuk Valley National Park. As you can see from the federal perspective, they believe that within NOAATAC, which is the northern one, National Preserve, that simply the main stem is navigable up to the confluence with the Aniak. Right there, you can see it changes to a blue and red hashed line. I had the fortune of floating it this last summer, the blue and red hashed portion ending at the Aniak. We took a hydrological measurement at that confluence point. The river at that point, where the BLM had determined the navigability stopped, was 320 feet wide. There were 3,088 CFS. Flowing past us at that point, that's 3,088 basketballs a second. in order to navigate a canoe or a raft down that portion, you would not find undue hardship or burden. Many of the waters that we are speaking to in this bill, many of the waters that we are addressing, are hollowed, large, significant Alaskan rivers. The Kobuk, the Noatak, elements of that nature. If we look what this looks like after our efforts in creating the list and creating the map, we see quite a bit of growth in state ownership, management, and control. You will note that there is still pink on this map, that there are still undetermined portions. There's a recognition that through the analysis discussed previously in this hearing, that we have not put our feet in the water. We have made conservative calls. We have gone much farther downstream than we would if we were boots on the ground, understanding navigability from a navigability in fact standpoint. So some of the calls we have made have been conservative in that nature. Further, when we're looking at the undetermined nature of some of these rivers, though there are issues at hand, it is our belief as a department that Alaskans are due navigability determinations as a matter of law. If they could just say one way or another, whether a river is navigable or otherwise, we would at least have an administrative remedy to move forward, whereas the ambiguity does not benefit any one person. With that, I will pass it back to Mr. Walker, Section Chief.
So again, in moving through these slides very quickly, we've talked about the other aspects of the bill, particularly the susceptibility criteria that is derived from case law. Many of those cases cited here are also incorporated as standards that will be utilized by the department in making navigability determinations. Certain points about the types of criterion craft, modern day use is sufficient, navigability does not require a clear channel, no two-way traffic is required, etc. All of these standards are derived from federal case law and are added as portions of the bill. We talked about the geographic scope of the legislation. It only applies to federal areas statewide. And we also have definitions of key terms, such as ordinary high water mark, line of mean high tide, etc., that are defined in this bill, consistent with federal case law and with other definitions within the code. We have an annual reporting requirement, which we have already discussed. It is our position that the navigable, in fact, and tidally influenced rivers and the submerged lands under them are part of Alaska's birthright. It's one of the fundamental promises of our statehood. It's been 64 years. Very little progress has been made by federal authorities to acknowledge state ownership. And after 64 years, I respectfully submit it is incumbent upon us to try. To try to force the issues, to try to call the questions, to try our best to bring closure, bring finality to these decisions. And I submit that a Senate Bill 92 is a bold step in that direction.
Thank you. We're going to go to Mr. John Sturgeon, President, Safari Club International, Anchorage. Mr. Sturgeon, it's 4:45, and if you could keep it under 5 minutes, I'd appreciate it.
I'll keep it a lot less than 5 minutes. Good afternoon. My name is John Sturgeon for the record. I'm testifying today as president of Safari Club Alaska and its 750 members. We support Senate Bill 92. I'd like to sincerely thank both chairs and the committee members for listening to my comments today. The state of Alaska is incrementally being cheated out of one of its most cherished and valuable sovereign rights, the right to manage its navigable waters. Like every other state, management of many of its navigable lakes and rivers are being withheld by the federal government. The state of Alaska must take strong, decisive action immediately or watch while it loses management over thousands of miles of rivers and thousands of lakes. Remember that 80% of Alaska towns and villages don't have road access. Their roads are Alaska's. Thanks to two U.S. Supreme Court decisions, Sturgeon versus Frost 1 and 2, the court unanimously ruled the state of Alaska has a legal right to manage all navigable waters and lakes and submerged lands beneath them, regardless of the upland ownership. That took 12 years and $1.6 million, which was contributed by thousands of fellow Alaskans. Unfortunately, the federal government has been extremely slow in conveying title to these navigable waters and submerged lands. I said earlier, only 9% of navigable waters, rivers have been adjudicated. This is despite of numerous lawsuits by the state of Alaska on navigable waters. The state has not lost even one of those lawsuits. It is clear that there had to emerge a definition of what constitutes a navigable waterway in Alaska. It's just impossible if there's not. But the federal government refuses to come up with a criteria of what is a navigable water. The courts have made decisions, and like I said, it's just not reasonable that there wouldn't some reasonable people couldn't sit down and say this is what constitutes navigable waters in Alaska. And a state I know has put forward several lists of criteria. The federal government has refused all of them. However, even with these court losses, the federal government continues to try to redefine what constitutes a navigable waterways. Either the federal government is intentionally driving down the process, or they're totally inept, and most likely both, to be quite honest. This is a, Jim Walker said, this is a bold step forward. Senate Bill 92 provides a declaration by the state of Alaska which rivers they consider navigable and available by the state of Alaska. And what it does, it plants a flag on those waterways saying to all the people of Alaska, all the citizens of Alaska, these are the lands that, the submerged lands and navigable waters that the state of Alaska believes it owns. Thank you for your time. I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Mr. Sturgeon, if you would you send in your comments to our office? Because I want to get them in the record. You came in a little broken up a couple of times, and I want to make sure the record reflects accurately what you said. So if you would get those into us, it would be greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Will do. Next, thank you very much.
You're welcome. We're going to go – I'm going to take a stab at this pronunciation. Mike Seawright, a retired assistant attorney general in Anchorage. Can you hear us?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. We can hear you really good.
Good, because some of the senators might break up a bit. Let me know if you have any problem with me. Yes, your pronunciation was correct. May it please the committee, through the chairs, I will try to keep my comments brief. It's going to be tough because I have a lot of history in this matter. So let me get right to it. I support this legislation. Why? Simply put, it recognizes and identifies in the new section or code, AS38.04.063, navigable waters, waterways within and adjacent to national parks, refuges, etc. In other words, also referred to as federal areas or federally owned land. I see this bill as very educational and very helpful, and it very well could lead to less litigation because it would lead to less uncertainty, at least in terms of the federal agencies knowing where the state stands. One, as a voice of the legislature, it has added importance. Secondly, again, it identifies the waterway. This is very much, in my mind, like the RS-2477 legislation that the legislature years ago passed, as I understand it, recognizing over 600 historic trails under that federal law. Here, the legislature would be doing the same thing. And DNR would then be able to publish a bulletin, much as it has with RS-2477, identifying those waterways and saying the legislature, not those waterways, but those trails and roads, saying that the legislature recognizes this. This is the state's position. It's not Jim Walker's position. It's not even the commissioner of DNR's position. It's the legislature's position. So I support it for that reason. The rest of this legislation would make some amendments to AS 30.64.062, which already exists in statute. But the real heart of this legislation is the identification of these waters. I say I think it could lead to less confrontation, less litigation. Why do I say that? First of all, the federal government to this point has had a very bad history in the court on navigability issues. There are two processes that have been going on, two dynamics. First, back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, it was the land selection process. Both the state of Alaska and the Alaska Native Corporations had the right to select land from federal lands as part of statehood and as part of ANCTA, which settled the native lands. And so back then, the federal government, contrary to the law that existed through the U.S. Supreme Court for pretty much two centuries, the federal government took the position that Alaska, in the wrong way, was different. In Alaska, the federal government took the position only those waterways like the Yukon, the Kuskokwim, the Susitna, that could handle large volumes of traffic by very big boats, basically barges, et cetera, were navigable. That was contrary to the law that had been established for centuries in the lower 48, because there, navigability was recognized, the state's right to the submerged land and paramount control of the waters as a result over those lands was established by evidence or the susceptibility of a waterway to use by state fur traders who would pull or walk their or way up or canoe up a stream, say, do their trapping for the season, then in the spring come down the stream. That was found, that evidence of a navigable waterway, and those were found navigable waterways, contrary to the federal government's position in Alaska. Now, in Alaska, I was the lead attorney at the Department of Law throughout most of the 1980s. Litigating those test cases. The chief one there, by the way, I submitted an article to Mr. Huff for the committee's consideration. It's something that John Sturgeon and I collaborated on, or I should say collaborated on, 3 years ago. It's entitled Hunter Access, What is a Navigable Waterway for Public Access Under the Sturgeon Decision? And what that article does is go over the three of the main test cases that were decided in the late 1970s into the 1980s. The chief among those, because it became real precedent, was the Volcano River case. Why did it become precedent? Because the federal government was trying to transfer much of the bed of the Golcano River to a regional native corporation, whether the regional native corporation wanted it or not. As part of the native corporation selection process, the federal government was trying to transfer this land that the state felt belonged to it. The Golcano River was decided in the state's favor. It went up to the Ninth Circuit Court, and the Ninth Circuit Court wrote a very good opinion. By the way, the district court also wrote a very good published decision for the lawyers on the committee in the EFSA. Anyway, as a result of the Golcano River decision, well, the Golcano River decision, by the way, was also appealed by the losing party to the U.S. Supreme Court, which, as the lawyers will understand, at least the lawyers on the committee will understand, by denying cert, the Supreme Court let the Ninth Circuit Court decision stand as the law. That is the law for Alaska, and that continues to be the law for Alaska. Now, as a result of that law, the federal government had to change how it was taxing acreage against native corporations that belonged to the state. DNR did an estimate years ago that as a result of that, the state became entitled to somewhere between 8 and 11 million extra acres of upland as part of its selection process, because it already had the right under constitutional law, the Equal Footing Doctrine, Submerged Lands Act, et cetera, already had title to the submerged lands underlying navigable water. So the state really gained. So did the native corporations. The estimate there was about an extra 4 million upland acres. The native corporations were not going to get taxed for that river, for those river bottoms and the gravel bars and sand bars. So that was an important dynamic. Then the second dynamic that gets us to where we are today and why this particular legislation is important. The agencies that have really dug in their heels, and it's separate from the selection process that I referred to that was ongoing and is almost complete by now, the agencies that dug in the heels were Park Service, the refuges, et cetera. Think of them kind of like a cattle land baron in Wyoming in the 1880s or 1890s, has all this land under its domain. All this area, waterways, land, etc. Then some homesteaders, they have rights too. Well, that kind of gets in the way of the easiness of managing your cattle land. The Park Service, the refuges, they run into a situation like that. They're going to resist that. So they made another mistake. They made a mistake on the Volcano River case. They made another mistake. They kicked John Sturgeon off the Nation River, which had been determined NAFTA by a court decision. And in doing so, he took that all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And this time, the U.S. Supreme Court said, yes, indeed, Alaska is different. On the other side of the spectrum, part of the trade-off with the NILCA legislation in 1980, basically doubling the Park Service's holding and the refuges holding and all those federal agencies holding, doubled their holdings from what was in the lower 49 states. Part of the trade-off was Alaska would not, Alaska's waterways and other inholds, native corporation lands, state selections, native allotments, lodge properties, cabins, et cetera, those various private or state or native corporation inholdings would not be subject to park regulation.
Mr. Seawright, could you wrap up your comments and send the rest of your comments to the committee, because I find it fascinating. I'd like to read it, but we've got one more bill and 2 minutes to get it done in.
Okay. Wrapping up my comments, these listings are, you know, they may seem like small waterways, but the test for navigability in Alaska is small use and susceptibility use by small boats. It is important legislation. If I were a park manager, I would be saying to my employees or personnel, here are waterways the state of Alaska, the legislature has identified as navigable in the state's perspective. Be careful with these. Don't create confrontation. Don't create confrontation that's like the Sturgeon decision. Don't create confrontation that, by the way, a few years ago resulted in the federal district court awarding something like $700,000 against the federal government because it found the federal government's opposition to a navigable waterways case frivolous, in bad faith. Avoid that confrontation. That's why I think it's a good educational tool. That's why I think it can be very positive, avoiding litigation, getting people working together. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your comments. Okay. We're going to set this bill aside. Next up is Senate Bill 67, PFAS use in firefighting. Senator Geisel.
Mr. Chairman, I move adoption of the committee substitute for Senate Bill 67, Work Order 33, LS0148/S-Sierra, as our working document.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'll object for purposes of discussion. I'd like to invite to the table Senator Jesse Keel, the bill sponsor, and Ms. Kathy Schlinghide, staff, Senator Keel to explain the changes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, Jesse Keel, Senate District B, and with me is Kathy Schlinghide on my staff. There are two changes in this committee substitute for which we owe Department of Transportation, Public Safety, and DEC a lot of thanks. The first you'll find on page 1 at lines 10 and 11. It shifts the carve-out for the oil and gas fires, the major hydrocarbon fires. Instead of being specifically who owns the chemical, it's what fire you're fighting. That's more closely tailored to the real problem. The second is on page 2. For the take-back provision, DOT did some excellent research into the code red carts in rural Alaska and found that the 25-gallon limit we had in the bill would have required 2 take-back sessions for many of those communities, and that the cost of that take-back could be cut dramatically if we took up to 40 gallons a year because there's a 35-gallon partially mixed tank. So, with great appreciation to the departments, Mr. Chairman, it's an excellent CS.
Thank you. Seeing no questions from committee members, brief at ease to pass out the new fiscal note. After I remove my objection, okay. Brief at ease. Legislative Liaison, Department of Transportation, would you please come up and review the fiscal note?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Andy Mills, Legislative Liaison Special Assistant at the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. I'll expedite this as quickly as possible. We did a fairly extensive review on the language when we found out a couple weeks ago that DOT was the intended party when it said the state accepting this. And so when we found that out, we did a lot of research on this. DOT before this was not associated with the Project Code Red initiative, but we did look into that and found, as you'll see in the analysis, that numerous parties had some good information to offer us that would help us get to a quantity. So to shorthand this, we found out the Project Code Red, over the course of 15 to 20 years, funded by federal and state dollars, and training provided by Rural Fire Protection, is my understanding, that gave 138 was the original number of villages. It was anticipated to be 220-some, but funding did not get that full amount. In your packets, you do have, of course, the analysis, the list of 135, and a few of those villages and sites do not have that substance anymore. So 132, we'll note, is the number of sites that we anticipate having PFAS or firefighting substance that would need disposal. We do also have a manifest list that was provided by Rural Fire Protection on the equipment that was a part of that as standard. However, I do want to underscore that we're working from a lot of assumptions. There's no current inventory in each of those villages, so they may have used all 5 gallons. They may have procured additional amounts. So what we have in as part of this fiscal note is the assumptions all laid out on what we think is out there. And again, not being a part of the program, we could not find any inventory that was available for that. I'll also note one more item on here that the language in Section 1, Item D, is it, that speaks to the disposal, it does say a person
domiciled in the state. And I will make sure to specify that I looked up the definition of a person in AS 0110060, and it says a person includes a corporation, company, partnership, firm, association, organization, business, trust, or society, as well as a natural person. So I want to be sure I underscore that the intention of this, as was described to us, was to deal with the Project Code Red firefighting substances, and that's what we could quantify in this note for a cost for that capital appropriation and the one personnel to handle contracting that effort. However, we easily could contemplate there are additional entities out there that would seek to utilize this, and there's no way we can quantify at this time what that amount would be. So as we put in the fiscal note, it would be essentially a first come, first serve on any party that demonstrated interest and wanted this program to work on that disposal effort up to, again, with the CS, 40 gallons per year. I'll pause there for a moment if you have any questions.
No, I don't have a question at this time. I can take it offline because it's, you know. Okay. Any further questions? Seeing none. Senator Giesel.
Mr. Chairman, I move the committee substitute for Senate Bill 67, Work Order 33, LS0148/S-Sierra from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Seeing no objection, the bill moves from committee. We will sign two documents and be done for the day. Next meeting is Friday, March 31st, 3:30 p.m. On the agenda is Cook Inlet update from the Department of Revenue. We are gaveled out at 5:08.